Thank you very much. It's great to be able to walk into a room in Europe and be all primed and ready to make the case for a stronger policy with specific punitive measures and have your keynote speaker just come and take the air right out of your sails. I don't have anything to add. I think it's exactly the right message is that the policy up till now pursued by Washington, Brussels, the United Nations Security Council, in general terms, taking away some of the rhetorical differences, generally, the policy that has been pursued till now has been one of constructive engagement, we called it, during the 1980s when the world dealt with the apartheid regime in South Africa. It's gentle persuasion with the occasional speech to mollify or pacify your constituencies at home. We are pursuing an incentive-based strategy rather than a pressure-based strategy. And I think that the empirical evidence over the last 18 years with respect to the government of Sudan will overwhelmingly dictate that only when multilateral, not unilateral, multilateral pressures are pursued, particularly through the United Nations Security Council, to put the scarlet letter, to put the shame, the naming and shaming, and the specific measures, punitive measures against the government of Sudan, but backed by very strong diplomacy. You don't disengage when you place these pressures, you engage more directly on the diplomatic track. That's the winning combination, and that's what's needed now in Darfur. So I'd like to just provide in 3 or 4 minutes a framework for the policy response that tracks very closely with what you've just heard. And I think in any one of these major crises in Africa over the last decade or last 2 decades, you need these 3 ingredients to be deployed simultaneously to have any chance of a successful intervention, a successful response. Not intervention is, of course, a word that's mischaracterized, but a successful response to the crisis. And the 3 tracks are peacemaking, protection, and punishment. We call them the 3 P's of genocide prevention, of conflict resolution. And the first P is obvious, peacemaking. Why has it taken 4 years, as this Darfur crisis has festered, to have any significant, clear, singular international diplomatic track to resolve the war in Darfur? We've had all kinds of ad hoc, episodic efforts, culminating in this horrendous agreement that was signed in May 2006 called the Darfur Peace Agreement, which actually made matters worse. We need very clearly and very quickly either coalescing around the leadership or the diplomatic leadership of Salim Salim from the African Union and Jan Eliasson from the United Nations, backed by a set of governments who have leverage with Khartoum. We have a very successful model in southern Sudan where 20 years of war was ended by an African-led mediation supported by 4 countries which had some measure of leverage or at least relationship with the parties to the conflict in the south. We can replicate that. It costs nothing. It just requires serious resolve and leadership. So that's peacemaking, the easiest one. Yet it's still churning. Still, we haven't seen that effort come together. The protection one is probably the most difficult one because, of course, even while you're trying to make peace, even while we're trying to work diplomatically at resolving the conflict, people are dying, people are being raped, people are being killed, people are being displaced in Darfur today, and people need to be protected. All the speeches, the wonderful speeches that get made around the world about never again are just ringing so hollow in the ears of the refugees in Darfur and the displaced people in Darfur. I spent a lot of time in there over the last 4 years, and I can tell you their only hope is these wonderful speeches that they hear on the radio or that they hear about, made by people like President Bush and others, and then waiting for some sign that the world is going to respond and seeing nothing. So protection involves either the significant increase in pressuring the government to accept the model that's on the table now, which is this hybrid model of the African Union and United Nations force of 20,000 or whatever number of troops it's going to be, getting President Bashir and his cabal to change their minds, or simultaneously, frankly, to accelerate planning, even if it's not going to be done, to accelerate planning for some of the other military measures that could be deployed if Khartoum remains intransigent and opposed to the deployment of this internationally agreed force. And we know what those measures are. The no-fly zone has a lot of complications. We can debate it for the rest of the day. Non-consensual deployment. Not one soldier has been signed up or would be signed up today to such a venture, so there are many problems with that. But if planning were to commence and be accelerated, particularly within NATO, and there was a transparent process of planning that would send a message to Khartoum that that option is not off the table, and it would influence and strengthen the hands of the mediators who are trying to negotiate a peace deal. So it's peacemaking and protection, and then the third P that undergirds the first two is punishment, is accountability. How can we let 4 years go by, whatever you want to call it? International lawyers can debate it. Crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, genocide, all the terms that we've seen over the last 4 years. But for us to have responded as a collective international community with targeted sanctions against four individuals, two of which are government official, one of which is a government official who was retired, a Janjaweed leader, a rebel, and who was the fighter? I don't remember. Two rebels. Imagine this. This is the worst kind of lowest common denominator, equal treatment in the context of mass killing, no matter what word, again, what terms you want to use. So we need to change the policy from this constructive engagement to one which utilizes punitive measures. And the punitive measures are clear, and they are not expensive. Once again, it is simply a matter of political will in Europe, in the United States, in New York. And those measures are, we already heard, I just want to reinforce them, targeted sanctions against a much wider set of actors in the presidential palace in Khartoum, particularly, but any other rebel leader who's going to undermine peace or commit atrocities. It's freezing the assets of the companies that the Sudanese government has set up since the oil was developed over the last 10 years, freezing those assets, starting to hit them in their wallets, or at least putting a spotlight on those companies that are profiting from the suffering of the people of Sudan. The United States is using a new vehicle with respect to North Korea and Iran, in which they basically choose a couple of banks that are servicing Iranian and North Korean business and give the bank a choice. Either you continue to do business with those countries, and if you do so, then you will lose the business of the United States. It's up to you. And if we can work, put together a coalition of states that can do that for some of the banks that have serviced Khartoum's, particularly oil transactions, that could have an impact, at least in raising the cost of doing business for the Sudan government. And then most importantly is the legal instrument, supporting the ICC to accelerate its investigations, to get to some of the senior leadership of who has orchestrated the crimes against humanity we've seen committed over the last 4 years. Those actions taken together, no single action by itself will move this government. Taken together, ratcheted up, demonstrably supported by the international community, you will see a change. The final thing I would say is just to echo, and we can talk about it in the discussion, is the only way this is going to happen is if we see much more robust citizen action. Because every one of these governments in Europe and in North America have one interest or another, and we can go through the catalog of the litany of reasons why they are pursuing the course of action they have pursued up till now, this policy of constructive engagement. The Americans, we all know, are deeply engaged with the Sudanese government in counterterrorism activities. So while they issue the speeches and the press releases about the genocide in Darfur, on the other hand, they're cooperating very closely with the same individuals who have orchestrated what they call genocide to work on counterterrorism imperatives. In Europe, there's a whole mix of reasons that I'll let my European colleagues on the bench here discuss, so as not to be accused of bigfooting, of being an ugly American, which I may or may not be. I'll leave that to your own discretion and judgment. However, I would conclude by saying that is really the answer, is that it's going to have to be citizen action, citizen campaigns, to demonstrate to their governments in every one of these countries that it is in our interest, in our global interest, in our human interest, even if it's not going to be defined as a strategic interest to stop human rights violations in Sudan, that it is in our interest as an international community to involve ourselves more rigorously to protect civilians, to uphold this wonderful concept of the international responsibility to protect, which has seen one of its first major tests, and we are failing so dramatically. We've got to make it politically costly for some of our political leaders to talk about doing things on human rights, to talk about stopping genocide, and then not acting commensurately. Thank you very much.